This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Over the years, North Carolina has built a positive reputation as a state with excellent colleges and universities. Higher ed was seen as a plus and funded accordingly. But in recent years, here and around the country, people have begun to scrutinize what college costs and comparing those costs to how much students and their parents receive in return for the money. The cost of a college education has been rising, and in many cases, students are saddled with huge amounts of debt when they leave school. Aside from the price of an education, the reasons to pursue that education have also come under scrutiny. Colleges and universities have been accused in some circles for being ivory towers that don't understand how to prepare young people for 21st century jobs. It could be argued that college has become the new high school, a place to go for 4 years if you want to get a job, not necessarily a place to expand your intellectual horizons. Today we talk about educational excellence, about the value of a college education, and other topics that seem to be swirling around the halls of academia. And we talk about it with the leaders of four area colleges and universities. Dr. Philip Dubois is chancellor of UNC Charlotte. Nice to have you with us. Dr. Carol Quillen is president of Davidson College. Nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
Dr. Ronald Carter is president of Johnson C. Smith University. Good to see you.
Good morning.
And Dr. Tony Zeiss is president of Central Piedmont Community College. Nice to have you back as well.
Thank you.
All four of you have been here, and you still came back, so for that, I salute you. With budget cuts to state universities and with criticisms that colleges are, that they cost too much today for students and aren't the value that they once were, do you all feel like you're under siege in some way?
Well, I think being a college president is one of the great jobs in the country, but it is challenging. And the trends you mentioned are national. They're not unique to North Carolina. The public investment in higher education for the public institutions, which in this room would include Tony and myself, has been going down for the last 25 years. And whereas tuition used to be virtually nothing, or at least in my career in higher education, about 20% of the total cost of the education. It's now at UNC Charlotte closer to 40%.
And that has happened because?
Because state appropriations have declined.
And is that why the cost to the individual student has risen at public universities?
That's right. It's a pretty simple equation. If the state appropriation goes down, the tuition's going to go up.
So when politicians rail against the rising cost of college education and saddling young people with unsustainable debt, it's their fault.
It is partially their fault, and you know, with respect to higher education as well, at least on the public sector, the decline in financial aid has been significant. Mm-hmm. So the federal government has not done its part, although it's made an effort. They're no longer support year-round for financial aid.
Are schools like Davidson and Johnson C. Smith, are they isolated from these pressures because you are private institutions?
No, we are not isolated from the pressures, but I think it's important for us to ask some very practical questions when we talk about the rise in the cost of higher education. What did we pay professors in 1920, and what must we pay them in 2015? Mm-hmm. What did we pay for gas in 1910, and what do we pay for gas in 2015? We have all been suffering from the escalation of the cost of living, and we have to make sure that we keep the lights on. We have to make sure that we have the right people in place, that they can feel comfortable, good about what they're doing. So these are all costs that we must deal with. And for people just to simply say in very sweeping terms, the rising cost of higher education, I always ask the person who says that, when is the last time you got a raise mm-hmm. and demanded one?
Dr. Quillen?
I actually would agree with Ron that there are more fundamental questions that would enrich our conversations about this. Higher education is actually being asked to perform a wider range of functions, and we are in the process, I think, of renegotiating our social contract with the country so that as we in higher education assume responsibility for educating more and more and more and more of our citizens for a 21st century economy, we need to figure out how to do that, what kind of partnerships we need to do that, how to fund it as a country, acknowledging that education is a public as well as a private good.
What do you mean by a wider range of functions?
First, simple numbers. more and more and more people are going to college because a college degree is actually one of the most valuable things you can acquire for lifetime income. That remains true. A big problem with respect to debt, which you mentioned, is non-completion. So to the extent that we can help our young people and other of our Americans who are returning to college, to the extent that we can help them complete their degree, the danger of default and crippling debt goes way down. So I think the questions that we need to ask are much broader. We're being asked to educate a wider range of people for an economy where jobs are uncertain. Our graduates hold jobs that didn't exist when they entered college. Very few people stay in the same career for their entire working lives, so that different skills and talents matter now than they did when you could go to work for one company for 40 years. That's a wider range of functions. Our nation is much more diverse than it ever has been before. And middle income, you know, family income has been stagnant while wealthy people seem to acquire more and more wealth.
And So
it's just a different environment.
And it seems, Dr. Zeiss, that all of this plays to your strengths.
Exactly, particularly in the economy that we're in today. And what's on everybody's mind is a job. And will my son or my daughter's education lead to a job? But we don't want to leave out education, the education part. We don't want to leave out liberal arts. It's very important. But it's also important for those employers to know that those students have some skills that can help them be productive in their organization.
Well, let's talk about this, because it seems to me that one of the things, aside from the rising cost of college, is that there's been a change in focus or a change in attitude about the purpose of going to college. I think it has become the new high school, because you used to be able to get a decent job with a high school education. You now need a college education to get that. So the focus has shifted not from going to college to learn about Plato or discuss philosophy or maybe study European history from 1850 to 1550. It's been, what kind of a job can I get and what will it pay? What does that do to your jobs as college president?
Well, the question of whether a college degree should be instrumental to getting a job might be the wrong question. For me, we're preparing students for life, which includes their job. And when a student gets a broad liberal arts education, they're getting the skill set that employers tell us they want. They want people who understand the world, who have traveled abroad, who know how to write and think and speak. And so sometimes these things get traded off between preparatory education for a specific career, which, as Carol pointed out, students are going to change their jobs many times over the course of their lifetimes. And I think all of us are probably examples of people who have done okay with a liberal arts education. Mm-hmm. I was a political science major. I didn't know I'd end up being a college president. But I think the fundamental skill set that I derived from that education has served me pretty well.
I read speeches and papers and articles that all four of you have written over the last several years, and many of them had to deal with just that, this idea of a liberal arts education. And we've heard, at least in North Carolina and perhaps around the country, leaders say that the focus needs to be on funding schools that give students the preparation they need for a job on graduation. That people want to go major in history, that's great. Pay for yourself. Don't expect us to do this. But all of you have written about the value of a liberal arts education, and many people may not understand that. So talk about that.
Well, let's ask the question, a job for what purpose? What jobs do we want people to fulfill? And how do we want them to fulfill the jobs? We talk about people having a sense of well-being while they're working. Well, what makes for the well-being? Is it just the mere fact of doing the job? Or is it an excitement? Is it learning to manage exceptions? That's innovation. Is it the ability to see what's coming down the pike? All of that comes with the ability to think creatively, analytically, and in practical terms. And that's what a liberal arts education is about. I would say we need it all the more to begin to challenge some of the false conflicts that are coming from those who raise the question, why liberal arts as opposed to a job? It's always a job for what purpose?
And you've said, Dr. Quillen, that Davidson has become even more committed to providing liberal arts educations, even in the face of questioning of a rising tuition and the purpose of college. Why rededicate yourself to that purpose?
Liberal arts education describes a particular philosophy of education, not a set of disciplines, right? So that if education is to develop the ability to think critically and from multiple perspectives, the ability to speak persuasively across multiple audiences, the ability to collaborate and work in teams, and the ability to bring creative approaches to seemingly intractable problems, that's what that education has always done. That's what it did when Socrates was talking to Greeks under the trees in Athens, and that's what it does now. And I think that is exactly what employers are asking for. I think the public conflates major with career. So they think if you're a history major, then you want to be a historian. I happen to be a historian. And so for me, I went to graduate school and became a college professor. 90% of the history majors at Davidson College do not do that. They become CEOs and lawyers
and activists
and doctors.
How does that prepare them to do those jobs?
I will give you an example of a theater major who is now a pediatrician in Dallas, who said to me, I use my theater every day in my job as a pediatrician, and I don't use organic chemistry at all. So I just think the subject matter and the courses of study that develop the very talents and skills, empathy, the capacity to listen, the ability to see things and to see patterns in data, which right now is a huge issue with the emphasis on big data. That's a visual artistic skill. Mm-hmm. So I think we conflate major with career path, and that leads us to devalue the very activities and enterprises that help us develop talents employers tell us they want.
Of course, Dr. Quillen has a little cushion because she does work at a private college. Dr. Dubois and Tony Zeiss, you both work in publicly funded institutions where the pressures are different, and you are dealing with political pressures and with politicians who don't necessarily, at least out loud, admit what she just said and what Dr. Carter just said to be the facts. How do you handle that?
Well, Tony and I both have a range of programs that serve students with diverse kinds of needs and objectives for their college education. So we offer a range of liberal arts. We also have business. We have engineering. We have nursing. We have health sciences. We have a whole range. So the students can choose. But I think all of us would believe that we would be shorting our students if any of those majors failed to provide students with some grounding in the fundamental skill set that Carol and Ron talked about. Mm-hmm. And I'll let Tony speak as well, but I think one of the things you forget about all this is the value proposition of higher ed. Students are getting college degrees because they not only result in higher lifetime and annual earnings, they are college graduates are more likely to be healthy, less likely to be on social welfare, less likely to be in trouble with the law, more likely to vote and give philanthropically. There are a range of individual and societal benefits that come with a college education and that are important.
You have 35 seconds, Dr.
So at Central Piedmont, of course, our focus is a little different in that people expect to get the skills to get a job. And so they typically come there because it's a two-year program. About 25% want to transfer to one of my colleagues' institutions. Mm-hmm. The other 75%, they really want to get jobs, like veterans returning now. They want to get the money to get some jobs. And so our majors do lead to jobs, but we give full disclosure if they don't.
Actually, CPCC has kind of a split focus, which I want to talk about, because you have two missions, actually, that you're trying to undertake. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Catt Wealth Consulting, LLC. Martha Catt is a financial advisor specializing in retirement planning for State of North Carolina employees. Online at cattwealth.com. We know very little, actually, about the most important organ in our body, the brain. But noted documentarian Noah Hutton has been following a project to map the brain, and he's bringing that film to CPCC's annual Arts Festival Sensoria. We're going to hear more about the film tomorrow, about the brain itself, from a neuroscientist. And we get a preview of just how Sensoria is working brain research into an arts festival. Should ask Tony Zeiss about that. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a new study says the amount of time parents spend with their kids has little effect on how they turn out. The latest research on quantity versus quality of time parents spend with kids.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. What's your take on the value of higher education for today's workforce? Are liberal arts still relevant in our increasingly technical world? We'd like to hear from you about that on Facebook or Twitter or email at WFAE or charlottetalks at WFAE.org. We're sitting here with four college presidents. I'm the dumbest person in the room. Dr. Phil Dubois is Chancellor of UNC Charlotte. Dr. Carol Cullen is president of Davidson College. Dr. Ronald Carter is president of Johnson C. Smith. And Dr. Tony Zeiss is president at CPCC. We're going to talk about this split focus that CP has as we go through the program. But you have said, Dr. Zeiss, that students today are seeking colleges that are affordable and provide the knowledge and technical skills leading to a rewarding career. I think that's probably true, but is college the best place to get that?
Well, I would say certainly at community colleges, because that's pretty much their focus. But other colleges, I mean, any college, any university can do the same thing. I thought Carol brought up a good point about majors, and we do oftentimes equate majors with a job skill. So if you major in humanities, there are lots of jobs out there, but no specific jobs out there. You gave an example, I think, Carol, of your person who majored, I forgot what he majored in, oh, theater, and became a pediatrician. I was a speech major and became a college president. So those things do happen. But for people who really are interested in a specific career, yes, I think they should be majoring in a field that they know will lead to employment in that particular field.
You have said, I don't want to take you terribly out of context, Dr. Carter, but you said that research shows that liberal arts majors flock to social service careers. But you also admit that as vital as those careers are, they pay less. Do students know that going in?
Some students know that. We tell students that when they come to Smith, but a couple of things I want to challenge here. First of all, I have been in higher education for 40 years in liberal arts colleges and universities, and I have yet to find one student who did not want to get a job. So let's just cut through all the nonsense that a community college is dedicated to getting folk jobs. Everyone who goes to college looks forward to having a career, okay, and we prepare them for it. Mm-hmm. Now, the second, we keep asking, what is the value of liberal arts? And we talk about philosophy, and I'm a philosophy major, and I'm a president of the university with a degree in philosophy. When is the last time anybody walked along Levine Way and noticed the Mint Museum and the Beckler and the Gantt Museum? Why do we spend all of that money to put up museums and art? And
well, there would be people who ask that question.
Yes, but then let's ask it for real, because when we say we want to attract businesses and corporations to Charlotte, we want them to know that they have a cultural experience. So who will run the museums? Who will paint? Who will sing? Who will dance for all these folk who flock to Charlotte because they want a good life? We continue to put up unnecessary conflicts, and then we sit around and engage in intellectual masturbation until we get off, and then we sit back and say, wow, it's nonsense.
Okay.
I would just second Ron's point that all college students want jobs.
Yeah.
I would say college students want, our students want to lead and serve in the world. They want to have an impact in the world in whatever arena, whether they become CEOs or whether they become teachers or whether they become activists. They want to make a difference. And college is the place where they figure out what they care about in light of what the world needs and learn how to have the impact they can have.
But was it always this way? Wasn't college education a place to go to really broaden your intellectual horizons, to really understand more about the world or about your particular area of interest? And yes, you'd get a job when it was all over, but it was about being more educated.
I actually don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. I think they go together, and that our either or juxtaposition of becoming better educated or getting a job is odd. So what I would say is we at Davidson have recognized that we need to take more responsibility for helping our students move from our campus into the world of work. And so we have dramatically expanded opportunities for research, internship opportunities. We've added an entrepreneurship program. Mm-hmm. We've added computer science because we recognize that computer science is now part of the liberal arts. So there's a whole range of things that colleges like Davidson are doing to acknowledge the changing environment of the world of work and the rapidly evolving context in which our students will live their lives.
But did you need to do that? Phil Dubois talked a second ago about the success that liberal arts majors have in the world after college, and you have said, you've written, that Davidson does not offer pre-professional majors or focus on job-specific skills, yet 6 months after graduation, more than 94% of the class of 2012 were in professional graduate school or employed in a career-related job. 94%. That's enormous.
Yeah, but we want it to be 100. And so what we also recognize that that more of our students are going straight into the world of work and fewer are going to graduate school, right? That's true of professional schools, medical school, law school, and business school, as well as other forms of graduate school. We think that our employers are telling us that 2 years out of college, our students are fantastic. They would hire our graduates over anybody. But that straight out of the gate, they don't always have the precise skills they need to sort of hit the ground running. Yes, we're obligated to give them that. That in no way conflicts with a course of study they pursue in their majors. That is something that these transition to impact programs are designed to do, to complement a fantastic, unsurpassed liberal arts education with opportunities to develop what you need to hit the ground running in the career of your choice.
You're nodding in agreement, Dr. Carter.
Well, I wanted to press the point that Carol is pressing, that we're not learning in a vacuum. She said internships. Our students go into internship experiences to apply what they're learning, and they get jobs from that. That's a way of getting a job. But again, is it getting a job or is it getting a career? We keep saying that folk are going to change their jobs 6-7 times. What's the nature? What's the context for doing that? It's a career.
And you have this dual mission at CPCC because you are helping to prepare students for a 4-year degree. In many cases, not mm-hmm. all, mm-hmm. they come to you for the first 2 years because it makes the cost of a 4-year education slightly less expensive. And if they're in economic straits, that's a smart thing to do. They all come to you because they don't want to go to college. They want to get a specific job skill that prepares them for a specific area in the workforce. Which seems to be the most important or the more important mission for you?
Well, by statute, it's the job piece. That's the strongest one. In fact, the North Carolina statute says that we should have no more than 25% of our students transfer. Well, how do you monitor
that? You
can't
control that.
Yeah, but nevertheless, we have a wonderful relationship with UNC Charlotte. They most of our graduates go there when they transfer, and so we have 2+2 programs and all sorts of programs like nursing and engineering and I don't know what all, Phil, but lots of them, so that students can transfer and get the same credit, as juniors when they leave.
How do colleges, how do institutions like UNC Charlotte, like Davidson, like Johnson C. Smith look at a 2-year set of credentials from a community college student, not necessarily CPCC.
Our history is as a 2-year college. We started as Charlotte College.
Right.
And we served as Charlotte College from 1949 to 1961. Mm-hmm. So our institutional ethos is to accept and welcome transfer students. And in fact, half of our incoming class of new students every year are transfer students. That's not typical of a lot of big public research universities. So we welcome them and we try to array you know, 80-plus undergraduate majors that they can choose from. And going back to another sort of comment we've made this morning, we don't ignore what's going on around us. We see the pressures for different kinds of professionals. So, for example, right now, there's a huge demand out there for cybersecurity people. There's a huge demand out there for data scientists. And we're preparing those people. But we would be doing them a disservice if we didn't prepare them also to be ready for the next job. I don't think it's been 20 years since we had the last crash in the computer industry, right? And when I was president of the University of Wyoming, I watched kids go in and out of geology with a rising price and falling price of oil. So we have to be ready to be flexible for those kinds of changes.
How do you regard to your transfer students, or do you have them at Davidson?
We do. We have some. Increasingly, at schools like Davidson, we have been moving towards reaching out to community colleges to try to build a bridge to places like Davidson. There are some limitations in the sense that Davidson really appeals to people who are within the sort of convention 18 to 24 year old range, and so we look for students who are going to want that kind of residential environment, want to live with their fellow students, but it's been an important move at schools like Davidson. Ruth Simmons, in particular, when she was president of Brown, pushed all of us to really, you know, sort of highly selective institutions to really make this part of our mission.
We're hand in glove with community colleges. We have a articulation agreement with CCPC and with about seven other community colleges as a degree completion program. It's a place of choice. And I would say that half of our student enrollment will come in as transfer students from community colleges.
At CPCC, your efforts are focused, you say, Dr. Zeiss, on closing the skills gap and serving as a bridge to employment. That's by statute, to develop programs that will entice employers to locate here, customize training opportunities for existing employers, and helping the city become a center for advanced manufacturing and investment. It sounds as though your mission is almost to be a trade school that bolsters economic development. Would that be accurate?
Accurate, very accurate. We're the community's college, and that's, we often cite, that's the most important word in our name is Central Piedmont Community College. So we constantly measure where the community is and where it's going and where we think it needs to go. And so we get involved. We're very involved in the global vision for the region. In fact, we have 125 members of the Global Vision Leaders Group that's held. We've held now seven global competitiveness summits, and we work with the airport very closely. We work with manufacturing very closely. We want to be the best, this region, make it the best at creating things, making things, and moving things so we can take our place on the global stage. As a matter of fact, we already are there. We were listed as 40th of the top 100 global cities in the world. And so we're moving there, but we want to do what we can in terms of skilled workforce to help the region move further toward that goal.
On the other hand, Dr. Dubois, you have said that the world of the future is not about students' mastery of current knowledge and technology, but about their ability to adapt to changes in knowledge and technology, to work in teams, and to write, read, and think critically. You said that earlier today, and to be globally aware. That seems to be almost diametrically opposed to what Dr. Zeiss's university or
college
does.
I think they're complementary. The old expression, different strokes for different folks.
Who's right? Because he's teaching people to take the job today.
Well, and Tony will also tell you that he does a lot of work on retraining people for jobs that have gone obsolete or where sectors have died. Mm-hmm. We used to be a mill town, for crying out loud, so don't need any more of those folks. And I think that's the kind of flexibility your higher education system needs. In fact, that's one of the great things about Charlotte, that you've got a great public community college. You've got a significant public university. You also have Johnson & Wales, Johnson C. Smith, Northeastern, Davidson. You've got a potpourri of institutions that can serve the students. But the number one thing to remember is that degree attainment, and I said this earlier, not only benefits the institution but benefits the community. And so for every year of college, community college, private college, public college, that a student gets beyond high school, it raises the GDP of this community 17%.
Wow.
So it's a big deal. And that's why North Carolina and why Charlotte, they're focused on getting young, talented, highly educated people into this community.
We're going to jump to my ninth page of notes here then, because, because if that is the case, and that's demonstrable, if you can actually point to the 17% growth in GDP for every year of a college education, why around the country have we been cutting college funding?
Because there are so many demands. Well, I'll say two things. There are so many demands upon the public tax dollar.
But it takes money to make money, and this sounds like we're making money by producing college graduates.
I think there needs to be a more significant investment in the public education
system.
Because
there seems to be, and we've talked about this on this show, I don't mean to interrupt you, but there seems to be an anti-intellectual bias in this country. If you have a college degree or you quote a college professor, you're quoting somebody sitting in an ivory tower who doesn't know anything and should be ignored.
Have you run into anybody, Mike, in your lifetime who said, gosh, I wish I hadn't earned that college degree?
No. Okay. I'm just saying that there seems
to be. Gee, what a mistake that was. And a lot of times when you—
Well, maybe if I was saddled with $80,000 in debt and making $13,000 a year, I might feel that
way. Well, I'll have to agree with you. I'm a first-generation college student, and I came out with no debt. And I became a college president, and it's a miracle because yeah. If I had not had access to a public university where my tuition was $150 a year, I'd be doing something a lot.
And we're going to talk about that. But Dr. Quillen, you and Dr. Dubois have talked about the need to help students write and speak effectively and organize their thoughts and analyze complex problems and work collaboratively. Both of you have talked about that in regard to getting a liberal arts education. Are students being adequately prepared at high school to do that? Because with all this emphasis on teaching to the test and the testing that these kids have to go through, it's about multiple choice, true or false. It's not about a long essay questions comparing and contrasting and analyzing things anymore.
When I spoke earlier about higher education sort of renegotiating the social contract with the country, what are we being asked to do? This is one of the things I meant. I think it's on us within higher education to take responsibility for the whole ecosystem, the ways in which we educate our children from pre-K through college and graduate school. And so I think all of us here have extensive partnerships with K-12 in Charlotte-Mecklenburg and other parts of the country, designed to help our amazing high school teachers offer rigorous curricula that prepares their students for our programs.
Because I've read some papers by college students, anecdotally, and they can't write. They can't spell. They can't punctuate.
Spell, just
they can't
for the record.
You can't spell either? Well, that's why there's words.
That's why
see, 30 seconds. Go
that
ahead.
Doesn't mean that teaching is not going on. You have to look at the curriculum, mm-hmm. and you have to ask, does the curriculum include writing as opposed to literature? And there's a great debate around that in terms of how you teach people to write. Some will argue you teach them to write through literature.
Yes.
Okay, so it's the curriculum.
That's Dr. Ronald Carter from Johnson C. Smith University. We have to take a break. We're coming back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley Arant Bolt Cummings, LLP, a full-service law firm whose lawyers are industry professionals experienced in serving the banking and financial services industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation. Details at babc.com. A new study says that the amount of time parents spend with their kids has little effect on how they turn out. Whoa. The latest research on quantity versus quality of time that parents spend with their children. The topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to hop into our conversation about higher education, you can search for us on Facebook or Twitter at WFAE, or you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. We're coming right back.
American college students graduate, on average, with $30,000 in loans. German kids, most of them, not a single euro.
Majority of German voters agree that, you know, a decent start in life includes the possibility of free higher education.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. That story and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about college educations, the cost of college, the purpose of college, how college functions in the 21st century world that we live in, with Dr. Tony Zeiss, president of CPCC, Central Piedmont Community College, Dr. Ronald Carter, president of Johnson C. Smith University, Dr. Carol Quillen, president of Davidson College, and Dr. Philip Dubois, who is chancellor at UNC Charlotte. During the break, Dr. Zeiss, you said something really alarmingly illuminating, and that is over 50% of the students who come to you have to be remediated in what, writing and reading, college English? I mean, high school English?
Reading, English, and mathematics.
Why?
First of all, if they've been out of high school for a long period of time, they probably have gotten a little rusty on their mathematics, and when they take a college entrance exam or whatever the measure is, they need a refresher course. But for recent high school graduates, the number has gone up substantially for the last at least 15, 20 years. But
so what's a high school diploma mean? If they get out of school, they can't read, they can't write, they can't add, they can't subtract, what does an education in high school mean?
I don't want to label any one high school. We need to be...
This is happening across the country.
It's across the country. I think that they are pretty much prepared for college, except in those areas, and they just get behind.
But in those areas, that's math,
and then
reading and writing,
critical areas.
Critical,
but
it's only three: reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Well, those
if
are
I
the three
correctly.
That we need. Yeah, exactly. But keep in mind that if they're behind by the third grade, they stay behind.
Yes.
I mean that's so it's a systemic problem that starts back even pre-K.
Again, you're nodding in agreement or in recognition, Dr. Carter. Talk about this.
Well, I'm nodding in agreement. Let me rephrase it. We have to ask who are the students we are now educating. Mm-hmm. When we look at students in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system pipeline, a number of these students has been touched by social services. Okay, they come with a lot of challenges and issues. We don't talk about how our great teachers, as Carolyn described them, and they are great teachers, have to spend a lot of time managing behavior in the classroom. And so there is very little time can be dedicated to teaching. And let's look at the size of the classrooms. When you have students who have behavioral problems and you have 20, 25 students facing you, no teaching assistant, what can really be done? And this is what I mean, that we've got to really mine down to the issues facing us.
Again, this goes back to money, and it goes back to money dedicated to education. And if we keep saying, and I keep hearing from the four of you, what educated people bring to the economy, it bolsters the economy, it reduces unemployment, it increases philanthropy, it increases civic responsibility, etc., and yet we keep cutting teacher assistants in the elementary and secondary level. We keep increasing class size. We keep decreasing budgets at that level and your level. What the hell do we expect?
Exactly. And education is not a priority for public trust. Bam.
I think we've stopped thinking about education as a public good. I think we think of it as a private good, as a way for an individual to become capable of making more money.
When did that happen?
Because, I don't know.
Because when we did think of education as being a public good, we also respected teachers more.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
I think if we could imagine education as something that we all have an investment in, that I care about the education of the next generation of children, not just my own child, mm-hmm. and that I have an interest in these third graders learning how to read so they don't fall behind as little kids in a way that we can never compensate. If we don't feel a collective investment in that project as citizens of this country, then I don't know how we're going to shift it back.
You're a historian, and all of you are college educators and have been so for years. So is this societal? Is it generational? Is it political, these attitude shifts? What is it?
I'll say all of the above. And when did this shift take place? Let me again be controversial. About around 1964,
So you're equating this with the Civil Rights Act?
Thank you. Because...
So you're saying, let me...
The education...
Let's be clear about
okay,
this.
Let me, okay, Mike, let me say to... The education that folk keep pushing and talking about was the memory walk when education at that level was set aside for white people. Mm-hmm. And then the question became, how do we massify this? How do we make this available to all the people, we the people? And that's when we had to start talking about cutting this, removing this, trying this, taking it back. I saw it in South Africa. I worked at Wits University, a great research institution, beautiful educational experiences. But then when it had to massify, a different conversation took place.
I think we can all agree on, for example, the importance of teaching and the difference that elementary and high school teachers made in our lives as we were
absolutely
growing up and preparing.
Why I'm sitting here.
That's why I'm sitting here as well. But I would say to you, when you realize that currently of the new teachers that are prepared in the state of North Carolina, and we prepare maybe the second or third largest number of them in the state, mm-hmm. 50% of them won't be teachers in 5 years.
Because?
Because of the conditions in public schools, the challenges of the work, and the low salaries. So what business would you devise where you're going to lose 50% of your talent in 5 years? And that just is not a formula for success. And one of the things research very clearly shows is that experience matters in teaching.
But there are tens of thousands of very smart people like you who know this. Who believe this?
But I don't.
Who espouse this?
I don't why, set teacher salaries, Mike.
No, but why not? Why aren't you influential in the conversation?
That's a very good question.
I think that's a completely fair. I mean, I think Phil is, but I think that's a very interesting question. And I think the ivory tower image of colleges and universities is in part a result of our sitting on the sidelines and not actually investing more of our time in shaping public debate. There's been recent calls that college leaders, college professors, college presidents, university researchers should become more active in public debates about policy, particularly the policy that affects education. If we're going to do that, we're going to learn how to speak a language that doesn't alienate people. And I think we haven't always taken responsibility for doing that. I do think that teaching in a broadly heterogeneous society where people believe different things, where they look different, where they come from different backgrounds is harder than teaching in a homogeneous classroom. So it requires more of our teachers, and we need to support them in developing the skills that you need to engage a very diverse group of students, whether they're 5 years old or 19 years old.
I'm going to share some things that have come in on email and Facebook and Twitter as we've been talking. Adam emails, I'm currently paying out-of-state tuition at ASU for online classes, $440 a credit, $440 a credit. The cost is of no issue to me, even though it is 100% federal loans. The cost doesn't matter to me because I have missed out on employment opportunities simply because I did not have a degree. If you are a competent individual, a degree can change your life and open doors that would otherwise forever be closed. Tom in Chester writes, 2 years ago, Dr. Robert Schwartz from Harvard was on your show. He pointed out that many advanced economies, such as Germany and Switzerland, have a different approach. In these countries, less than 50% of students participate in traditional four-year programs. Instead, they pursue apprenticeship programs linked to a local technical school. Dr. Zeiss is very familiar with this model. This alternative needs to be pursued aggressively as an alternative to a traditional four-year degree. I know you agree with that, Dr. Zeiss.
I do agree with that. In fact, we have probably as many apprenticeship partnerships as any school in the country, and it is one avenue for people to get good employment.
But you know, college athletic departments have been accused of being farm teams for the pros, particularly in basketball and football, the money sports. Does that mean that college also has to be the farm team for corporations to train employees before the corporations get their hands on them?
Well, no. However, should they be providing skilled labor for those corporations? Absolutely. It's where the jobs are. I mean, so as a matter of fact, business drives our curriculum at Central Piedmont, and probably yours too, because they're on all of our advisory committees for all of our 80 different degree programs, and they're the ones who determine what the competencies are that we're teaching in
just
business.
Just make a comment too. We've been talking about undergraduate education here, but the American higher education system is the envy of the world because of
– How long will that be so?
It is the envy of the world. And at the graduate level in particular, there are no close competitors. I mean, so these – there are something like 700,000 I think maybe closer to – maybe it's 900,000 international students enrolled in American universities right now. There's a reason for that because we do it better than anyone. Mm.
Dr. Carter, I know you want to say something about this. I can
I love my good friend Tony Zeiss, but he just continues to stay in that box, and he does not think that we don't do similar things. We also have corporate leaders and business leaders meeting with our faculty to talk about the knowledge base that they need in order to have an educated workforce. But this issue, again, we continue just thinking unconnected dots. We talk about preparing a worker at a CCPC, a student, for the global workforce. So who teaches that student to speak French, German, to understand cultural competencies? And wow, that sounds like we're getting back over into liberal arts.
Yeah.
We work together, people.
Let's get back to the cost of all of this, because the cost is an impediment to many people. And I left school with student debt. And I think the student – I don't really remember, to be honest. That's how insignificant it was. I went to the University of Maryland, but I was an out-of-state student. And I think I left with $15,000 in college debt, which I paid off over a long time, evidently. But today, students are leaving college with $80,000, $90,000 or more sometimes. Why have costs risen so much? Why does it cost so much more in real dollars?
I think you'd have to – let me address first the question of student debt, because you made a choice to go out of state.
Yes, I did.
And not to go to your public university in state at the rate then available to you. So some of this is choice. If a student chooses to go to a private institution versus a public institution, if they choose to go out of state, in our particular – and then as I mentioned earlier, in our case, it isn't that our costs are – out of control compared to what they were 20 years ago, although we do have some things that are expected of us that are different than 20 years
ago. Well, 25 years ago, funding has risen 2% in 25 years. Funding for college from the state government and the federal government has risen 2% in 25 years, and yet demand for that same education has grown over 60%.
In the last 5 years, I'm spending 14% less per student than I did 5 years ago because of the budget reductions and the growth in enrollment. So
the demand is increasing.
The demand is
increasing.
Funding
is going down, and the burden is carried by the student.
That's right.
Is that smart?
No.
No, it's not.
I mean, should it cost $80,000 to go to a public university? It should cost $80,000 to go to Davidson.
You got to remember now the all-in tuition and fees cost for UNC Charlotte next year will be about $6,400.
Okay.
Then you have the other things that go along, like room and board.
Yes.
Well, you'd be paying room and board if you were not in college. So, to some extent, the fact that they can borrow money to offset those costs is a little bit misleading.
Well, but you'd be paying room and board if you had a job. Otherwise, you'd be moving back home with mom and dad, which many kids are doing today because of their debt.
There's the issue of sticker price, and then there's the issue of affordability. And Davidson meets the demonstrated need of all the students whom we admit, and without loans in the packages. That in and of itself doesn't explain the escalation of the sticker price, which is the question that you asked. It's a labor-intensive business, and as our students become more interested in doing original research and work at our institutions, the cost of providing the facilities that support that is greater. Our kids are incredibly talented, and we want to give them that education that will allow them to have impact when they leave.
According to the Charlotte Observer, Dr. Zeis, Governor McCrory's budget plan would increase tuition at many community colleges. What would that mean for your students?
Well, in fact, it would increase it for all 58 community colleges, because if the legislature were to adopt it. And I think it was only about $2 per credit hour. But over time, it begins to impact their budget. But we still have... we're very competitive. We have about $3,000 a year it costs a student to go to Central Piedmont, including tuition, and I better not say books, because some books have gotten very expensive, but somewhere around $3,000.
The same budget calls for cutting UNC's, the UNC system, by $50 million. Or 2%. Why, if we want to create jobs and we want to keep North Carolina on the map, do we keep doing this?
Well, you got to know what's behind the numbers. So the governor's budget also requested full funding for enrollment increases in the system. And then against that is netted a 2%, what they call a management flexibility reductions. Mm-hmm. So in UNC Charlotte's case, we'll come out way ahead. But for some institutions that aren't growing, not so much.
And you get the last word. Dr. Phil Dubois, Chancellor of UNC Charlotte, Dr. Carol Quillen, President of Davidson College, Dr. Ronald Carter, President of Johnson C. Smith University, and Dr. Tony Zeis, President of Central Piedmont Community College. Thank you for this hour. It was interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.